Operating Engineers versus Ward. Mr. Pearson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Dale Pearson. I represent Local 150 of the International Union of Operating Engineers, AFL-CIO, plaintiff below and the appellant here. Local 150 is a labor organization representing employees in the construction and other industries in Western Indiana, Northern Illinois, and Eastern Iowa. In 1994, Local 150 sought to purchase a parcel of land adjoining its union hall in Joliet, Illinois. Union president made a handshake agreement with the seller to buy the parcel, then dispatched the union's treasurer, Defendant Joe Ward, to help close the deal. The treasurer ultimately reported back that the land had been sold. In 2006, the union received information that Local 150 Treasurer Ward and a group of partners had purchased the property himself after Dugan had an agreement or handshake deal to do so. Local 150 sued Ward in the U.S. District Court, alleging he violated his fiduciary duties under Section 501A of the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act of 1959, also known as the LMRDA or Landrum-Griffin. The District Court initially denied a motion to dismiss, allowed the parties to take discovery, then entertained a summary judgment motion, and also permitted the defendant to re-raise a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. The District Court ruled ultimately that it lacked subject matter jurisdiction to hear the claim under Section 501B of the LMRDA. The issue presented here is whether the federal court has jurisdiction over a suit brought by the union under Section 501. Local 150 respectfully submits that the district court erred and that read as a whole, the plain language, structure, and purpose of the act, informed by relevant case law, permit the union to bring such a lawsuit in federal court.
That's really 501B, though, that makes that inference, right?
Correct, Your Honor. 501A is what sets out the fiduciary standard. 501B is then what specifically grants individual members the right to sue, and we believe implicitly indicates
after
that the union
the
can.
Labor organization or governing board doesn't act.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why aren't you arguing that the private cause of action for the union is implicit in subsection A?
We believe, Your Honor, that the statute itself in B that Congress intended to imply that the union had the right to sue and that to imply a right of action under 501A sort of adds an unnecessary level of analysis. Some courts have looked at it that way, that you're looking for an implied right of action using the Court v. Ash type of analysis. We believe that that analysis is unnecessary because we're not asking the federal court to imply a private right of action. We believe that Congress implied that the union could bring such a claim under 501B because of the way it's stated, giving the union the preference, in effect, to sue first. As an aside, Your Honor, the standards of 501A, there's no issue here, wasn't presented below in any event, that the conduct alleged would prohibit what the defendant, we believe, actually did. So it really is simply this jurisdictional question that's presented. We believe that Congress established under 501A a federal standard of fiduciary responsibility. As this court has stated in the Hood v. Journeyman Barbers case, 501 was a direct and far-reaching response to the mischief exposed by the McClellan Committee hearings conducted in the 1950s by Congress with the express purpose of determining what problems existed in labor organizations, particularly corruption, and how best to address those problems. As this court observed in the Tile Marble Terrazzo case in 1992, the primary goal of Section 501A was to deal with the problem of corruption, specifically the corrupt management of union funds by union officials, but the language in 501A that says that union officials are prohibited from acting in an adverse relationship to the union would also prohibit conduct such as we allege was occurred here. As the cases cited by both the union and Ward indicate, The interpretation of a statute turns on reading the entire statutory text, considering its purpose, context, and consulting any authorities that inform the analysis. 501 creates a federal standard against which the conduct of union officials is measured. And again, as this court noted in Hood, Congress determined that a federal standard was necessary for the effective enforcement of these fiduciary responsibilities. As the 11th Circuit stated in the Statham case, the case that we rely on principally in bringing our claim that there is jurisdiction in federal court, Congress concluded that state remedies were inadequate to address fiduciary breaches by union officials, and that was one of the principal reasons that Section 501 was established. 501B does explicitly provide jurisdiction over such claims, explicitly for union members, and that, too, was part of the statutory purpose, to give union members the right to assert claims against unions in federal court. However, it's fully consistent with the congressional policy to allow unions to clean their own houses that the union would be permitted to bring the claim in the first instance, and that is also expressed in 501B, that the union basically gets the right of first refusal to bring the claim. It is, we believe, therefore implicit for the union itself to bring the claim in federal court, and that really is the only question here. The district court and defendants argue that basically Congress intended to leave the matter to the states, that the union's claim should be brought in state court. The reference to the union filing suit first does not specify federal court, thereby, they say, implying a state court remedy. We argue, Your Honor, that this runs completely contrary to the purpose of the Act. The purpose was to establish a uniform federal standard. It was several years of congressional hearings that led to this statute in the first place. There was no comprehensive regulation of unions at the federal level until the LMRDA was passed. The objective to address union corruption then found in 501A was not being resolved by state remedies. So permitting only members to sue in federal court doesn't make sense under the statutory structure. The U.S. Supreme Court has not resolved this problem. We do have a split in the circuits now, although the Statham case comes after the Guidry case decided in 1990. The Guidry court did observe that 501B expressly grants federal jurisdiction over a members' lawsuit, but then assumes without deciding whether the union itself could invoke the remedial provisions of 501B. It's the Statham case that then makes the jump that Congress must have inferred or implied a federal cause of action and federal court jurisdiction for the union. Statham makes the point that it would be futile for individuals to ask the court, to ask the union to sue if the union did not have the right to actually sue itself. The union might agree, or if it disagreed, the union could effectively frustrate the claims of the individual members. Your Honor, we also believe that the national labor policy supports permitting the union to bring such a claim in federal district court. As the Statham court said, and as this court said in Hood, a federal standard is necessary for an effective enforcement of this conduct on union officers. Federal district courts are accustomed to dealing with federal labor policy issues. The Congress, in many respects, seeks a uniform federal standard. The risk here is if we leave this to state remedies, then that uniform standard will go by the wayside. I'd offer the additional observation, Your Honors, that it's the union itself that has the resources to conduct such litigation, and again, that it's consistent with the national labor policy of non-intervention to permit unions to clean their own houses in the first instance. We're going to ask the court to reverse the decision of the district court and remand it for trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Mr. Decker.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel, this case is puzzling on a number of levels, not the least of which is the fact that it does not present the extended, difficult jurisdictional questions that Your Honors have seen, for example, in the Ho-Chunk Nation cases. It's a relatively straightforward contention being made by the union here, and it's one that was brought to the union's attention a week after the complaint was filed, when we filed a motion to dismiss on jurisdictional grounds. Judge Castillo chose not to deal with jurisdiction at that point, but the union could easily have zipped over to the state court right then. So it took another year then before Judge Castillo issued his opinion, finding that jurisdiction was absent.
So the union has common law fiduciary rights to enforce here against the defendant, is that right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And those predated the adoption of Section 501?
Absolutely.
And continue to this day. Then what's the import of Section A, if not to create a federal right of action?
I don't think there's any question that Congress felt that it would make sense to specify the types of fiduciary duties that were imposed on union officers.
But it's useless if those were already enforceable under state law.
No, I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor.
It serves no purpose if there isn't a federal action for the union.
Well, there were continual hassles over exactly what the fiduciary duties were. Now, but for 501B, I'd tend to agree that maybe it was a...
So let's talk about 501A.
A somewhat useless act.
If you want to focus on 501A, I'd like to do that too. And it talks about liability on the part of the officer to account to the union for profits received by him in any act of self-dealing. Certainly. That is described earlier in that subsection.
Certainly. Certainly.
Isn't that, by necessary implication, a federal right of action on the accounting?
Well, not by itself, Your Honor. You have to look at that point at 501B, which was part of the legislation.
It's clearly implicit in 501B that the union is going to have the first right to sue before its individual members do.
Yes.
And reading the two subsections together, it seems to me that by necessary implication, subsection A contains a right in the union to sue for breaches of the fiduciary duties in federal court, and subsection B supplies the right to the individual union member if the union fails or refuses to do so.
The problem with that approach, Your Honor, is that it assumes that jurisdiction can be created by implication under both A and B, or lumping them together. But that is not the test that's ever been applied here or anywhere else.
It's not so much a jurisdictional question, because jurisdiction exists for federal claims.
But
by virtue of the omnibus federal claim jurisdiction. And if this is a federal claim that has been created against a union officer for malfeasance, the question is who gets to bring it.
Yes.
And subsection A refers to the officer being held to an account to the organization for any profits received by him in whatever capacity in connection with the preceding breaches of duty.
Yes.
And it seems to me that's a declaration of a federal cause of action for an accounting to the union for breaches of fiduciary duty by its officers, and then subsection B supplies the corollary right to the union members if the union fails or refuses.
Well, she just heard counsel say that they don't rely on subsection A.
I understand, but we have to properly interpret this statute regardless. We don't accept legal concessions.
We'll pass that. What Your Honor is suggesting is that...
It's not jurisdiction by implication. I'm suggesting a private right of action on the part of the union by necessary implication because of the specific language of subsection A, and particularly when read in context with subsection B, which plainly contemplates the union going first with the claim.
Without subsection B, subsection A would not, standing on its own,
would serve no purpose.
Make much sense.
Right.
All right. But there was a legislative intent, which was the primary intent of the LMRDA Section 501, according to Judge Castillo below.
Well, we're not bound by what he says either.
I know. But the primary intent to which he alluded was to empower union members in combating corruption.
In the absence,
which was a
in the absence of action by the union.
Pardon?
In the absence of action by the union.
That's correct. Yes.
So the union goes first.
But the union goes first in a number of ways, none of which involves federal intervention. The union goes first, for example, by arbitration. The union goes first, second, by an accounting that may be established by union constitution. And
right.
Third, the union may sue. The union may sue. Now, the union always had the right to sue, and Section 501B doesn't take that away, but it certainly does not tell us that federal doors are open. Doesn't tell us that. 501A is totally silent about any litigation rights by either members or the union.
Well, it does void any exculpatory language in a union constitution for this sort of liability on the part of its officers.
Yes. Yeah.
Which implies that the cause of action is going to be enforced according to this federal statute for which there is federal court jurisdiction.
Well, there is federal court jurisdiction, yes.
Right. So
but,
this is not really a jurisdictional question so much as it is a question about whether the union has this cause of action or the union member or both.
Respectfully, Your Honor, this court has held before the whole chunk nation cases being the latest recent example that a case does not arise under 1331 for jurisdictional purposes unless a cause of action is stated. But you don't have a cause of action
right. Well, that's what I'm
laid
trying to
out
get
by
at.
A or B that would entitle a union to sue in federal court. It's simply not there. Now, Your Honor is saying there's an implied right, but that takes us over to an area that counsel again forswears, and you get into the court against Ash.
Well,
factor.
The court against Ash has been supplanted by subsequent developments in the Supreme Court about actions by implication, private right of actions by implication. So that methodology is really no longer operative.
But to back up for a moment then, Your Honor, to the right of implication, there still is a necessity, no matter how you view the issue, that there be a substantial federal interest in
there's lots of case
opening
law
federal
on that.
Doors. There is lots of case law on that. And there is not a case that says there's a substantial federal interest in making
in
district
labor
courts.
In labor-management relations? There's a lot of cases
Making district court jurisdiction available when state courts are open. There simply aren't any. The Statham case that has been mentioned here prominently by counsel doesn't say that. The Statham case was a 501 case, as Your Honor knows. And really finds an interpretive difficulty with 501B that we don't think exists because the statute is relatively straightforward. It simply says that a union member is entitled to present a complaint to the union. The union then has the right of first refusal. May either do something or the right reverts to the member to file suit in either federal or state court. And there's an express grant to the member to bring a federal case. We don't have that for the union. Your Honor's arguments are not the ones made by the union, but I readily accept the fact that the court is not bound by what the parties have to say about jurisdiction. I see I run out of time, and unless there were any questions, I'll ask that we rest on our briefs and that you affirm the judgment below.
Thank you, Mr. Decker.
Thank you.
How much time? You have 1 minute, Mr. Pearson.
With that 1 minute, I would just make the 2 points. In Hood, this court relies on the article that was written by Archibald Cox, published in the Harvard Law Review many years ago, which is often seen as the principal study of this statute. It is there that the court looks to guidance for what the purpose of the statute was with respect to 501A and the need for a federal remedy. Again, it makes no sense not to have federal court jurisdiction over the union's claim if that's one of the principal purposes of the statute. The inadequacy of state remedies was it's throughout the legislative history, including those courts that come down on the other side of this issue. I think that that's an obvious reason why you can't just relegate, and Congress did not intend to relegate the union to a state remedy. I also want to point out, Your Honors, that it's clear from this court's decisions in Cathus and others that the 501 claim, when brought by a member, is a derivative one, derivative of basically the union's claim. You bring in a lawsuit to rectify an injury to the union itself. So, again, it makes no sense not to allow the union to press that claim as well. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.